That's an odd question. He's leaning one hip on the ledge, and his hair has begun to dry in swooping waves. 12. Why? Such a thing will leave a mark, no? More or less, depending on your age. It was, almost certainly, the worst day of my life. But being 12 had nothing to do with it. Really? And what does my being 12 say? That it was terrible? But your face says that. I touch my jaw, my mouth. Does it? Finally, he touches me, just his fingertips against my cheek, then away.
Yes.
Things I don't think about tumble out of their boxes. The rumbling, the sound of breaking glass, my urgent dive for the door, lying flat on the ground in the open, counting seconds. I swallow, then take one step closer and rest my palm on his chest. He doesn't bend down to kiss me, as I had expected, but only presses his hand over mine, holds it there.
Life is capricious, no?
I think of getting to my feet when the shaking stopped, to find nothing left, the house in ruins. The absolute silence told me what I knew instantly. Still, I cried out my father's name, called until I had no voice left, called until darkness fell. I nod. He is the first to step away.
Shall we go?
I shower the pool from my skin and tame my hair with product, drawing it away from my face in the vain hope that it will behave for a few hours. To protect my skin from the harsh sun, New Zealand has some of the highest melanoma rates in the world, I bring a broad-brimmed hat. It's too hot for long sleeves, so I'm wearing the sundress again, and I slather on heavy-duty sunscreen. Carrying a rattan bag, I head down to meet Javier in the lobby. This time, I'm the first to arrive, and I wait by a bank of windows overlooking the square. Young people, mostly students by the look of them, sit in the sunshine, reading or talking in clumps of two or three. The girls have a wide array of color in their hair, sometimes silvery with purple ends or ombre shades of watermelon or leaves. One girl has streaks in a rainbow array, and she wears oversized sunglasses and bright red lipstick. It seems like a long time ago that I felt that young, so dewy, if I ever did. At 20, I was buried in textbooks, working two jobs to stay afloat. It didn't leave a lot of time for lazing around in the sun. I'm piercingly envious for a moment.
You look lovely, Javier says nearby.
I swing the red skirt. I only have the one. He touches his chest.
This is one of two.
It's a soft gray button-up with very thin blue stripes. Expensive.
I cannot bear to bring more than a carry-on.
I'm not that efficient, I admit, as we head toward the elevators to go down to street level. Inside, I smell his cologne, a continental touch I'm unused to.
I have become so over the years. Two good shirts, jeans, slacks, one pair of shoes, maybe a pair of sandals.
The door slides open, and we head outdoors to the heavy day. I slide my sunglasses down my nose. Whew, I'm not used to heat, I say. It's not this hot in California, at least not by the ocean.
I like California, he says. The people are friendly.
You've been there? Many times. He drops his own sunglasses over his eyes, very black aviators that give him a glamorous air.
It's beautiful. Where do you live?
Santa Cruz. He frowns slightly. Just south of San Francisco?
Ah, so you stayed there, even after the earthquake.
I've never lived farther than 60 miles from the hospital where I was born. Native Californian.
Is your family there?
My mother. She's staying with my cat.
Not the cat with her?
I laugh softly. He's afraid to leave my house, so she came to him.
That's very kind of her. I look up at him, recognizing the truth. It is. A sign alerts me to the shopping area I'd been hoping to find. I think this is it. How much time do we have?
As long as you need. There is no hurry.
I just want to duck inside here and ask around.
Of course.
In a bar of shade, I pause to pull out my phone and then find a still I lifted from the video of the nightclub fire. I show it to Javier.
This is your sister?
Yup. I look down at it, feeling butterflies flutter around in my gut.
You're very different.
I snort slightly. A very unladylike sound I wish I could take back. Understatement of the year. He cocks his head, and a swath of light undulates over the waves in his hair.
How so?
She was tiny, I'm tall. She loves, metaphor, and I love facts. I look up at the various shops, boutiques with seven dresses hanging in rows. It's hard to imagine Josie ever shopping for clothing like that. She was a complete hippie. I'm a doctor, an upscale florist, several restaurants. She was outgoing, and I was introverted. I don't say she was beautiful, I am not, but that might have been one of the more obvious things. Josie and Dylan and my mother were beautiful. I was the sturdy, sensible one. Not that I minded, honestly, except for that small, heady stretch of time when I fell in love with James in high school. Otherwise, I was relieved to be free of the demands of beauty. It didn't seem to serve any of them particularly well, after all. A cluster of professional women passes, wearing stockings and pencil skirts. The stockings surprise me, especially on such a warm day, and I stare after them, trying to remember the last time I wore a pair of stockings for any reason. Do people even do that anymore in the U.S.? Again, I scan the storefronts. Javier waits. For a second, I feel anxious and resistant and overwhelmed. Why am I on this ridiculous errand? And what am I going to do if I find her? The thought makes me feel queasy.
Do you wish to show her photo around?
I take a breath. I guess I do. He takes out his phone and shoots a photo of my screen.
I will try the shops across the way, yes?
Sure. He heads across the way, and I weave in and out of the boutiques and shops on my side. At the end of the row, he joins me, and together we approach the Italian restaurant I spied earlier on Google Maps. I pause, faintly nervous, to glance at the menu attached to an elegant stand, and my mouth waters a little. Oh, they have Sicilian-style cannoli.
What makes them Sicilian?
Ricotta inside instead of cream inside. So good. A tall, tidy woman with a shiny fall of copper hair stands at the open-air hostess stand, getting things ready for the day. As I approach, she gives me a bright smile.
We're not quite ready to serve, but I'd be happy to take your name.
No, thank you. I'm looking for someone.
Oh?
Her hands still on the napkins she's folding. I hold up the phone with my sister's face. Have you seen this woman? Her face smooths.
Yes, she's a regular, but I don't think I've seen her for a while.
A bolt of shock runs through my body, like lightning. She's alive. Do you happen to know her name? She cocks her head, and I realize too late that it's odd that I have her picture but don't know her name.
I know her as Josie, but I think her real name is something else.
Her face shudders slightly. And if she does know the name, she's not saying it.
I'm afraid I don't know.
Okay. I tuck the phone in my pocket, pushing down both disappointment and relief. Can you tell me if there was anything happening around here the night of the nightclub fire? Like an event or a concert or something? Her lips go pale.
Was she in the fire?
No, sorry. I just wondered what else might have been going on. She glances at Javier, and something I can't quite read crosses her face. Admiration, recognition, startlement. Her spine straightens even more. I can't think of anything. Thank you. I glance up at Javier and nod once. Let's go sightseeing.
Sure.
He touches the small of my back as we depart, and I see him nod at the woman. We head for the wharf.
Was that like your father's restaurant?
He asks. It has some things in common. The cannoli dessert, the fresh mozzarella, pasta with squid ink, and there's something, I look over my shoulder, about the way it looks. I think if my sister knew about it, she would probably like it. He nods and doesn't press me for more information. It's only a couple of blocks to the wharf, and we duck into the comparative coolness of the building.
What would you like to do?
Javier asks as we stand, side by side, looking up at the offerings. I'm deeply relieved to have something besides my sister to focus on. None of the names has any meaning to me, and I half shrug. I have no idea.
Shall we do everything?
Recklessly, I say, why not? He pays for the tickets, so I buy us some coffees in paper cups and a couple of pastries from a vendor. Settling on a white bench in the ferry building, I sip a flat white and nibble an apple Danish, watching Javier make a tidy diorama with a napkin spread wide on the bench, his coffee at one side, his pastry in the middle. After the morning swim and walk, I'm starving, and I watch people milling around talking to each other, the irritated kids hauled by their parents, tourists from everywhere. A line of people dressed in good hiking gear are lining up to board for an island volcano. The boat bobs gently. I love ferries, I say. Why? He's hung his sunglasses from the placket of his shirt and admires the flaky edges of his pastry. A finger of sunlight makes a shadow fan of his eyelashes across his cheekbone, exaggerating their length. He takes a lusty bite. I don't know, I admit, and think about it, naming the images as they pop up in my mind. The stairs, those tidy rows of chairs, the open air on sunny days. I sip my coffee. It's just being on the water, really. I always like that. In my family, we always say we can't sleep if we can't hear the ocean.
It is a soothing sound, he agrees. I like ferries because you climb in and the boat takes you where you're going. No bothering with maps and cars. You can read.
I thought all men liked driving. An expressive shrug.
Not so much, it says, but what can you do? It's a modern necessity, but it brings no pleasure most of the time.
I incline my head, trying to guess what he drives. Huh. I would have imagined you flying down some twisty road in a convertible. A very small grin lifts one side of his mouth.
Romantic.
Sexy. I hold his gaze. Like one of those 60s movies of the guy navigating the coast of Monaco. He laughs.
I'm afraid I would disappoint you.
I lean back. So what do you drive?
Volvo.
A small, translucent square of sugar falls on his thumb.
How about you? Or shall I guess?
You won't get it.
Hmm.
He plucks the sugar from his hand and tucks it in his mouth, narrowing his eyes.
I don't know American cars so well. A Mini?
I laugh. No, but they are cute. I drive a Jeep.
A Jeep? Like an SUV?
Not exactly. I need room to take my surfboard to the beach, so I scan the horizon. It's practical.
Ah, surfing.
He looks a bit perplexed. What?
I have to think how to say it.
I smile, knowing what the struggle is. Take your time.
I thought only teenagers surfed,
he says, instead of saying, aren't you too old for that? Well done. I crumple my napkin and drop it in the paper bag they gave us. Offer it to Javier. I started surfing when I was 7 years old.
I think of Dylan standing behind me on a longboard, his hands in the air beside me in case he needed to catch me. He never did. It's in my blood.
Is it dangerous?
Not really. I mean, I guess it is a little, especially if you don't know what you're doing. But I do. Have you ever tried?
I have never had the opportunity.
He leans backward against the bench, one arm along the top, the fingers of his right hand warm behind my shoulder blade.
What do you like about it?
I cross my legs, lace my hands around my knee, and look toward the water. I think of my palms skimming the water, the taste of salt on my lips, the board shivering under my feet, Dylan offering encouragement.
There you go.
That's right. You can do it. It's exhilarating to get a wave just right, ride it a long way. You don't think about anything. Just that. For a moment, he's silent, his eyes resting on my face. His fingers touch my back, edge along the bone, and it sends an alert through my body, 100% chemistry, which flickers and brightens the longer he simply looks at me. What? I say at last.
Nothing, he smiles. I like to look at you.
I smooth a hand over my hair, liking his regard, but also slightly tongue-tied, which is unlike me. I'm often the pursuer in these things, since men can be intimidated by my profession, my height. I drop my hand to my lap and look back at him, at his brow and his powerful nose, and the opening of his shirt, where I can see his throat. In the sunlight, I reassess his age upward. At first, I thought he was early 40s, but now I think it's more, mid-40s, maybe even slightly older. It doesn't matter. As I look, the light touch on my back combines with the steady, clear regard to give me a sense of expansion, as if the field of my energy is stretching out, trying to find the edge of his. It warms me. And I think of that study that says you can fall in love with someone by looking into their eyes for 30 seconds. I don't fall in love. But I think I'll remember this moment long years from now. His hand moves, open palm against my neck, thumb light against my earlobe. Who knows how long we stay like that, both of us captured. A voice announcing our ferry brushes against it, but doesn't kill it, like a spider web still clinging to fingers. He takes my hand as we board, and I'm glad of the touch, grounding me, connecting me to him, him to me.
Upstairs? He asks.
For a moment, I think of how bad my hair will be when the wind and humidity have their way. But I nod, and we take our seats in the open air, in the bright sunshine of New Zealand. As naturally as if we've been together 100 years, Javier picks up my hand and laces his fingers through mine. And even though it's a little sweaty and I'm not really the hand-holding type, I let him.
Chapter 10. Mari. Rose and I have flipped 6 houses together. She's a sturdy, busty, black-haired millennial who wears her hair very short. Her uniform is t-shirts with ironic sayings, jeans, and vintage Doc Martens. Her boyfriend wears a man bun in his curly hair and a thick beard that obscures what I am not sure is a particularly interesting face, but he's good to her, and that's really the only thing that matters. We meet at Sapphire House mid-morning, and she's squealing and ooing all the way through, much the way I did. But she's even more knocked out over the wood than I am. Her father runs a lumberyard, and she knows every variation of wood available in New Zealand and then some. With awe, she traces the inlays along the walls of the foyer and names the varieties of wood in the stairs, the banister, the framing, the doors.
My dad'll go blimmin' mad for this!
Her accent is as thick as they come, peppered with Maori slang, but when she talks quickly, I have a hard time deciphering her words.
I thought of him, I say. I wonder if he knows anyone who does tile work? I reckon he does.
Our process is smooth after so many jobs. She starts work in the first room to the left of the front door and heads clockwise around the main floor with a stack of post-its and duct tape in three colors, moving with surety through the rooms, tagging everything in a pattern we've developed over the years. She has a master's degree in furniture design, and I can trust her to know the difference between junk and antiques worth exploring. This particular era is her favorite. She makes furniture herself in a shared studio space with a handful of other artists, and they sell a lot of it in Napier, where an earthquake nearly leveled the city in 1931. When it was rebuilt, it was all done in the Art Deco style, which was very up to the minute, thus the inhabitants of the town wanting furniture. Eventually, I'm going to lose her to the furniture. But for now, she's invaluable. While she works on the main floor, I head upstairs with a kit of the same materials and start in the bedroom. Settling my box of tape and post-its on the bed, I open the French doors along the balcony and then step out to admire the view. My view. The sea is dark and unfriendly this morning, waves slapping the shore almost petulantly, and I smell a storm. I am as close to the sea here as I was in our house by the cove, where the window of the bedroom I shared with Kit hung practically over the cliff. If you stuck your head out, you could see straight down the rocks below, the little cove with its stairs off to the right, the harsh, rocky shore curving into infinity to the left, all the way to Big Sur and, farther still, Santa Barbara, and then L.A. I used to miss that coast, my coast, but New Zealand has cured me. It wasn't part of the plan. There wasn't really much of a plan. But it sometimes feels like a hand of fate brought me here, to the green mountains and the endless coastline of an island, where I would meet a man who was unlike any other I'd ever known, and fall in love with him, and marry him, and have his children. With that man, my Simon, who bought this house because I love it, I will sleep in this room with the French doors flung open, listening to the sea. A slight, faint aftershock rumbles through the earth, moving my body in an almost infinitesimal sway. My hands grip the railing, hard, and I wonder if the house has any protection from earthquakes. A flashback overtakes me, a sound memory, the beeping of alarms and water rushing where it shouldn't, and people making a song, sopranos screaming and tenor moans of fear and deep, bass cries of pain. I smell smoke and leaking gas. It fades relatively quickly. Just a flash and gone. All these years, you'd think I'd finally get over the PTSD. But it doesn't seem to work like that. My therapist says I spent so much time drinking and drugging away my trauma that it's just going to take a long time to work through it all. And even she knows only the tip of the iceberg. I was on a sad and terrible errand that day, awash in scalding shame mixed with grief, emotions too large for the child I was, though I thought myself so adult. A lot had already been lost by the day of the earthquake, but the way it completed the wreckage of our lives, Kit's, my mother's and mine, marked us all irretrievably. Sometimes I miss them most when I want to touch that reality, that day standing on the bluff, looking down at the collapsed heap of timber and concrete on the beach, all of us clustered together, howling. Enough. In the bedroom, I get to work. The bed is covered with a silk spread that is too fine to be original. I take a photo of it and then the bed, pulling back the spread to look at the mattress, ancient and unimaginably dusty. From my cut, I take a notebook and scribble information as I shoot photos. The closets are a dream, enormous, as would be needed by a movie star in all her dresses. Where have they gone? I make a note on another page to look up the history of Veronica's death and the disposal of her things. Maybe the sister donated all of them or something. In the bathroom, I make note of the light fixtures, light bulbs, colors of tile work, but there's not much that we'll need doing here. It's untouched, practically brand new. Someone has cleaned it regularly, so there's no dust built up anywhere. A pair of long, multi-paned windows open toward the sea, and I crank them open, letting in the breeze. A sharp scent of seaweed and salt triggers a visceral memory. Sitting on a blanket with Kit, eating tuna sandwiches and Little Debbies our mother had packed into a basket for us the night before. We carried it down to the beach after a breakfast of cereal and milk at home, as we often did. She didn't like mornings, our mom. The morning was cloudy, smelling of sea and rain, and chilly enough we wore hoodies and jeans. Cinder sat with us, chewing on a piece of driftwood between his paws. Kit said,
"Is this Monday?"
I plucked a leaf from my sandwich. "You know it is." The restaurant was closed on Mondays. Our parents were sleeping late, and we'd learned well enough not to disturb them.
"Aren't we supposed to go to school on Mondays? You don't have to go every day, especially not in kindergarten."
I was in second grade, and aside from lunch and the rows of books we were allowed to check out, didn't care a lot about it. I had taught myself to read before I even started school, and who needed all the rest of it? The other girls were snotty, and they liked dolls and dresses and all kinds of dumb stuff. I liked only books, Cinder, Kit, and the ocean. Kit's hair was braided into one long plait, but then she'd slept on it for a couple of days, and now curls sprang up all around her face and the top of her head like she'd stuck her finger in a light socket. Freckles covered her nose and cheeks, darker with the sun all summer, and her skin was almost as dark as the wooden walls of the restaurant, deep reddish brown that made people say we couldn't even be sisters. But she just took after my dad. His pale olive skin, his dark hair, his big wide mouth. She was tall like him too, as tall as me, even though I was older. Now she said,
"But I'd like to go to school. We learn good stuff there."
"Ew, like what?"
"We have a plant experiment in the window."
"Doing what?" She took a bite of her sandwich and chewed it thoughtfully.
"We planted 5 different seeds to see which ones grow faster."
"That's dumb."
"I like it. They have different baby leaves. Some are round and some are pointed. It's interesting."
"Huh." I didn't want to say boring, but I thought it.
"School is something to do."
"We have plenty to do." She shrugged. "You could tell Mom you want to be there every day." Her lids dropped.
"She'll yell at me."
I poked her foot.
"I'll tell her then. I don't care if she yells at me." "You would?"
"I guess." I flung hair out of my face. "If you want." She nodded, her big green-gold eyes shining like coins.
"I really, really want to go to school."
In Auckland, decades later, I run a finger along the tiled sill of the window. It wasn't until Dylan came, another whole year, that she got to go to school every day. He made sure of it. After making notes in the bedroom, I begin the second part of my day, scouring the house for papers, letters, diaries, anything that might help me put things together about Veronica's past. As I'd already discovered, the bedroom had been cleared out and never used again, and the study had proven to be no help at all. In Helen's suite of rooms, I find stacks of magazines, some dating back to 1960, carefully stored in plastic bins stacked to the ceiling. I mark them trash with a Sharpie. In a closet, I discover heaps and heaps of yarn, every color and variety and weight, which I note on my clipboard will go to the charity shops, along with most of the paperback books, mostly a very old-fashioned form of romance, and the kind of thick novels about the upper classes in England that seems to go over well with a certain set here. I'd never seen them in America, though Glitz novels probably fill the same need. I scan the books carefully, one title at a time, but after several tall stacks, realize there isn't going to be anything I need to save. It's hard to turn my back on such a wealth of reading material, but I learned early in the flipping game that I'd rue carting home a lot of books. My own reading threatens to bury us, so I don't need to bring any in from somewhere else. On my clipboard, I note, "Used bookseller, who often pays me a sum by the yard just for the chance to find anything important." The rest of the rooms have even less to offer. They contain the last modest possessions of a reclusive old woman. Her television is from the 90s, and the desktop computer that sits in one corner is a behemoth of yellowed plastic. I turn it on just out of curiosity, and it takes a while, but the screen finally comes up. It doesn't appear to have an internet connection and boasts very few programs. A word processor I haven't seen in use for quite some time, and a few old-school games. I smile, thinking of Helen in her flowered dresses playing Free Cell. I click on the word processor, and while it readies itself for the enormous job of opening, I check a text that has come in on my phone from Nan.
Got your message. Meet for early dinner?
I leap at the distraction from my empty house. Yes, the usual.
5:30?
Yes.
I'll make a reservation.
Pleased at the social prospect, I tuck my phone into the back pocket of my jeans and scan the list of files on Helen's computer. It's tidily arranged, with a file for letters, one for daily tasks that I quickly discover is a list that can be printed, and one for other. I click on that. Journal entries. I open a handful of them just to see if there are instructions or anything in there. It makes me feel guilty. Journals are very, very private things, and you never know, going in cold like this, what you'll find. In this case, however, it's a simple accounting of her day. She knitted a pair of socks for a neighbor's child, ate toast and jam for breakfast, needed to leave an envelope for the cleaners. I close it up again, but I'm not letting the computer go. I feel protective now of Helen's privacy. The rooms are sunny, with good light and views toward the sea. Simon will be very comfortable having his study here. Maybe we can turn one room into a little kitchen. As is my habit, I stand quietly in the center of the big room and let it speak to me in color and style. Here, as everywhere in the house, the bones are excellent. The windows are the star. Rows of squares, each framing the view in a new way. I'll leave them uncovered, but maybe on each end hang some heavy drapes to pull across on rings. No. Bare. Clean. That's what Simon will like. A masculine shade of green and the carpet taken up. Bookshelves that Rose will want to decide upon. The good wood detailing stripped and restored. As I'm heading downstairs with my notes, it occurs to me that Helen must have kept journals all along. What did she do before computers? And where did she stash them? There must be an attic or other storage. I walk along the open upper gallery, peering at the ceiling, and at the end, there's the loop. Glancing at my watch, I realize I've been at it for hours, and if I'm going to make my dinner with Nan, I've got to get down to the CBD. If I time it right, I can capture a parking spot from a departing office drone. Rose is cataloging the items in the pantry. Find anything interesting? I ask. She nods, gesturing with her pen toward the glass front shelves. Somebody collected cold pork cups and saucers. They're amazing. She takes a cup out, dark blue with gold interior, and a pattern of stars or dots on the outside. Breathtaking. Are they worth anything? Some, definitely. Some, maybe not. Beautiful, though. She shakes her head as she returns the cup, picks up another with a wide background and elaborate, colorful enamel work in red and pink and yellow. She loves vintage everything, and I don't always see the appeal, but these cups are amazing. They'll inspire you.
Yes. Are you leaving?
I'm going to meet Nan in the CBD. Do you want to stay?
No.
She makes a face, looking upward. This one feels a little more alive than I like.
I nod.
I get it. Nearly scared myself to death the other day. She settles the cup in its place and closes the pantry door. I've got heaps of notes I'll type up later and send over to you, but I got a pretty good start. Tomorrow or the next day, I want to get into the attic. I'm looking for things like papers and anything that might have belonged to Veronica. Clothing, jewelry, notes, scripts, any of it. Might be a museum that'll want them.
No doubt.
Want some feijoas? I ask, smelling them on the breeze as we walk out. There's a ton of them around.
No.
My mum has two trees, and I'm already ducking her.
I laugh. See you tomorrow.
Chapter 11. Kit. The harbor tour allows us to disembark at any number of stops. Javier and I wander into a little village with thick shade beneath the trees and rows of Victorian-like houses.
The air is hot and still, the mood very quiet along the streets. Peaceful. He points at things now and again, but seems content to simply take it in. I like that he doesn't feel the need to fill every silence with words. A bookstore draws us both in, and I lose him within 2 minutes when he dips down an aisle of moldering history books. I wander on by myself, looking for light reading to bring back with me. But there isn't much in that category. I content myself with leafing through a book of botanical drawings, then a history of flowers. I wind down a few more aisles, turning this way and that, until I'm somewhere in the deepest heart of the place, surrounded by the hushed whisper of the books and the faint, dusty smell of them, in front of a deliciously huge collection of children's books. I pick up a couple, open them at random to read a page. Nancy Drew and the Boxcar Children, Harry Potter in many different formats, some regional work I don't recognize, and that intrigues me. I shoot a photo of their spines to look for them later. And there, in the middle of it all, is a battered copy of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I gasp a little under my breath, as if someone dead has come back to life, and pull it out, holding the weight gingerly in my hands for a moment. It's the same edition we owned, a book Dylan brought home from a trip to San Francisco. I open the cover, flip to the first page, and fall back in time. To a cold afternoon long ago, me and Josie with Dylan between us. I leaned into his hard ribs, smelling the soap he used to scrub his hands of garlic and onion. "I can't wait to read this to you," he said. "It's such a good story."
"I can read it myself," Josie said. And it was true that at 8, she could read anything she wanted.
"But if you read it," Dylan said, "then we don't get to sit here like this, together."
He dropped a kiss to each of our heads.
"Doesn't that sound better? We can read a chapter a day before you take showers."
"Why do we have to take showers every day?" I asked, falling across his lap. "Mommy doesn't make us."
He pinched my side, tickling me a little, and I giggled, shoving his hands away happily. "Because you smell like little goats after you've been out there playing in the sand all day."
"We take showers in the ocean," I yelled, and he laughed, putting a finger to his lips. "A boy in my class told me I had disgusting ankles," Josie said, holding one skinny leg up for inspection.
"It's kind of disgusting," Dylan said, grabbing her leg. "Scrub it tonight."
"Scrub it how?" Josie asked.
She licked her thumb and rubbed at the grime, and it started to give way.
"Quit it," Dylan said, slapping her hand. "It'll wait until you shower. You can use soap and a washcloth."
I liked lying across his legs, looking up at him. I could see under his chin, where little shimmers of blonde whiskers caught the light, and his ponytail hung over his shoulder, bright and messy. It was safe with Dylan, warm. Although I complained about the shower, I liked having someone who knew when our clothes needed to be washed and who made us follow a system. Shower, brush and braid hair, brush teeth, lay out clothes for the next day. My sense of worry had calmed a lot since he'd arrived.
"I can see up your nose," I said, giggling.
Dylan laughed.
"Get up, you monkey. Let's read."
I scrambled upright. Josie crossed her legs and leaned in, her long, long hair falling like straw over her skinny limbs. Dylan took a breath and turned to the first page.
"These two very old people."
25 years later, in the dusty bookstore with a copy of the same book in my hands, I hold very still to let the cactus spines in my lungs settle. From experience, I know it will get worse before it gets better, that I can't move, only breathe with the shallowest breaths possible, and it will still be like a hand brushing back and forth against the spines, creating waves of deep pain. Each spine is a memory. Dad, Dylan, Josie, Mom, me, them, surfing, s'mores, and all of them ache at once. As I stand there, breathing shallowly, I can sense a person coming down the aisle. But if I move, it will take longer for the ache to disappear. So I stand there, head down, as if I don't know the person is there. Maybe they'll turn around and go back. But they don't. He doesn't. Javier touches my upper arm lightly. Are you all right? I nod tightly, lift the book to show him I've been looking at it. With a sensitivity that's rare, he settles one warm palm against the very center of my back and holds out the other for the book. I let go of it. When I can speak, I say, "Did you find anything interesting?" He gives me a wry grin, one that lights a dimple in his cheek. "Many things, but I have learned to just carry one book, or my bag starts to weigh too much for me to lift." He shows me a book of Pablo Neruda poetry. "This one, for now." "But you already have a book." "No, I finished that one. I can leave it behind for someone else." The ache has eased enough that I can laugh a little. "I'm taking that one, but I do know what you mean." He hands the book back to me.
"You'll have to tell me about it. Shall we find lunch?"
"Absolutely." At the counter, he sets his book down and holds his hand out for mine. I think about arguing that I have the money, but it's a small kindness, and I don't have to push it away. "Thank you." The village is geared toward tourists. At least it is by the waterfront. I know from experience that the town itself will have normal homes and people and schools and supermarkets. It bemuses me that this tourist town is much like my own, that everywhere the land meets the ocean, there is probably some variation on this idea. We have a wealth of options, but I love the look of a sandwich and tea shop situated in an old building, and we're shown to a table by the window, overlooking the harbor and islands and bluffs. Somewhere out there is my sister. Now that I know it for sure, I feel a renewed sense of urgency. How will I find her?
"You are troubled?"
I half nod, half shrug, trying to dislodge the emotions the book raised. "A little. I don't know how I will find her. I mean, how do you do that in such a large city?"
"You could hire a detective."
He gives the word a Spanish inflection. I've thought of this. Maybe I will, if I don't find her another way. Then I straighten. I've agreed to this day trip with Javier because I didn't want to be lonely, and I owe him my attention for the afternoon. "This is an insanely beautiful place," I say. Javier, holding the menu lightly, admires the view along with me.
"It's restful to look at it."
A note in his voice pricks my curiosity. "Do you need rest?" I ask lightly.
"I needed time to,"
he gestures to include the room, the table, the view, me,
"enjoy the world."
A youth with a tumble of black curls asks us for a drink order. I'm not sure yet what the local standard drinks are. What's an L&P? So I order sparkling water. Charmingly, Javier orders lemonade. We study the menus. "I keep seeing kumara on menus. Is it a squash or something?"
"Sweet potato," he says. "Miguel explained to me."
Eyeing the kumara soup and a white bait fritter, as well as classic fish and chips, I decide to go for the adventure, the fritter and soup. Javier orders oysters. As he hands the waiter his menu, he's framed against the light from a window behind him. It halos his hair and the square solidness of his shoulders, casts his profile into relief. High brow, powerful nose, full lips. I like the elegance of his shirt, his ease in the world. He taps the book, cradled in a paper bag.
"Tell me about this."
"Oh, that.
The ache of memory comes flooding back. Did you ever see Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory?
I know of it.
This is the novel it was made from. He nods, his hands loosely clasped in front of him.
And?
I sip water. My parents sort of adopted a runaway who worked in the restaurant. Dylan. How long has it been since I've spoken his name? A faint ache runs along my ribs. He lived with us for years and years, and this, I smooth a palm over the cover, was his favorite book. He used to read it to my sister and me.
What is the story?
A poor boy in the slums of London finds a golden ticket in a chocolate bar and is given a tour of a chocolate factory run by an eccentric man.
Why did your friend love it?
I consider the question. There is so much I don't know. What his history was, though he'd clearly been beaten within an inch of his life. Who his family was. All he ever said about his mother was that they used to go to Chinatown sometimes. Aloud, I say, Charlie is a poor boy who finds the winning ticket. There's magic in a candy factory, right?
You miss him.
Not just him. How to explain such a tangle of loves? My mother smoking in the kitchen as Dylan read aloud, the smell of coffee thick in the air. My sister chewing on the end of her hair. My dad singing somewhere as he engaged in some physical task. All of them, really. Maybe even my little girl self. His big hands reach over the table to take one of mine, engulfing it completely.
Tell me about them.
Oh, I do not want to like him so much. Lust, yes. Not like. I don't know him at all. But in this gesture, I feel the heart of a lion, big and inclusive and wise. It tips open the closed doors of my life. I take a breath, think of those days, and again find myself telling him the truth. Maybe it's him, or maybe it's just time to tell someone. We were wild children, all of us, even Dylan. He must have run away, because he showed up like a ghost one night when he was 13 or so, and just stayed. My mother took him under her wing. I shake my head. It's still a mystery that she did that, but she loved him as much as we did, right from the start. My sister and I adored him. I look out at the water. Even my dad, who was kind of a hard man in some ways, loved him. It was probably the best thing that ever happened to Dylan.
Why?
I remember his scars, some small and pale, others long, thin lines, others fat and red. I didn't realize it then, you know, but knowing what I know now, he must have been abused physically. It makes my skin hurt to think of it, of his small, gentle self, so heartbreakingly beautiful, being punched or cut or burned. His body bore the evidence of all those and more. For a moment, a wave of loss and longing threatens to swamp me, a longing for that time, for Dylan himself, for the terrible things he suffered. He took care of us, Josie and me.
Why didn't your parents care for you?
The answer is so complicated and so intimate after everything else that I'm relieved when the waiter brings a basket of bread and Javier releases my hand. Offering me the basket first, holding it with courtly manners while I select a round brown roll, he selects a seeded one and lifts it to his nose.
Algarabea, he says.
I gesture for it, and he offers the roll so I can look at it. Caraway.
Delicious.
Every gesture he makes, every expression, is as smooth and graceful as every other. Nothing is hurried or overly considered. He flows moment to moment, in a way I don't remember ever noticing in a human before. I smile and butter my bread. And as if he senses I've reached a wall, he turns the conversation.
Tell me, Kit, is it Catherine or something else? Were you like a fox kit and your father gave you the nickname?
As he speaks, his gaze is focused intently on my face, as if whatever words drop from my mouth will be endlessly fascinating. I had a professor once who looked at me this way. She was a nun, and I knew her in my third year of undergrad. I bloomed in her presence. I'm blooming now. It was my father's doing, I admit. He thought I looked like a kitten when I was born, and he nicknamed me. My mother still calls me Kitten sometimes, and Dylan used to as well, but everyone else calls me Kit. I was quite a tomboy.
Tomboy? I do not think I know this word.
Not very girly. I didn't like dolls or dresses. His hands are stacked, just the fingers. Quiet.
What did you like?
Surfing, swimming. Something in my spine loosens, and I lean forward, smiling as I remember. Searching for pirate treasure and mermaids.
Did you find them?
His voice is lower, his dark eyes very direct. I look at his generous mouth, then back up. Sometimes, not very often. He nods very faintly. It's his turn to look at my mouth, my shoulders, the square of skin showing in my dress.
So was it Catherine to start or Kitten?
Catherine. It was my father's mother. And I, sadly, look just like her.
Sadly? Why do you say such a thing?
I shrug, easing backward, away from that swirling thing growing in the air between us. I don't mind, but I was not my sister or my mother. He tisks.
I saw that photo of your sister. She looks small,
wispy.
Yes.
Never mind this conversation. I didn't mean...
I know.
He grins almost mischievously. I laugh lightly. You're teasing me.
Perhaps just a little.
Now you, tell me something. Why do you have your name?
The whole name is Javier Matias Gutierrez Vélez de Santos.
Impressive.
I know.
He inclines his head, easing the arrogance.
My father is Matias, and my mother's brother was Javier. He was killed by a jealous husband before I was born.
I narrow my eyes. Is that true? He raises his hands, palm out.
Swear. But I was never the boy who would be killed that way. I had big glasses, you know, thick.
His hands went to his eyes to illustrate the shape.
And I was a bit fat, and they called me Cerdito Ciego, little blind pig.
Before he even finishes the sentence, I'm laughing, the pleasure coming from somewhere in my body that I'd forgotten.
I don't know that I believe you. I swear it's true, every word.
He glances over his shoulder, leans closer.
Do you want to know the secret of my transformation?
Yes, please. I whisper.
I learned to play guitar.
And sing. He nods.
And sing. And then it was like a magic spell. I could sing and play, and nobody called me the little blind pig anymore.
I believe that story. Your voice is beautiful.
Thank you.
His eyes glitter.
Usually it doesn't send women running away.
No, I'm sure. He touches my arm.
Will you listen again sometime?
That swirling thing expands, engulfs us, and we're enclosed in a world of our own. His thumb rests on my inner arm, and I see that his irises are not as dark as they first seemed, but lit with amber. Yes, I say quietly. Sure, I don't mean it.
Good.
We make one last departure when the ferry stops at Rangitoto. Ordinarily, it would just be a pickup, but another ferry has been waylaid, and this one is going to do double duty. We have to wait an hour for everyone to come off the mountain.
You're welcome to disembark and explore a bit, if you like, the steward says over the loudspeaker. Be warned, we'll be leaving at 1600 hours.
Rather than sit in the hot sun, we opt to explore. I'm wearing walking sandals, and Javier is in jeans and good shoes. So we don't go far, just up to the visitor center and a small lagoon where birds hop and twitter and gather. I hear long fluid whistles and a squished little squawk. And around us are plants I've never seen. My mother would love it, and she'd probably be able to identify many of them. I'm drawn down a path shaded by tree ferns and land ferns and a pretty flowering tree. A bird overhead seems to be engaged in a long whistling conversation, and I grin, looking up to see if I can find him. But there are only more ferns and leaves and tropical-looking things. My heart suddenly turns over. How remarkable that I'm standing here in this place. It's amazing. The rustle of wings alerts us, and Javier touches my arm, pointing to the bird who's been making so much noise, black with a thick brown saddle over its shoulder. I admire it in wonder, mouthing, "Wow," to Javier, who nods. We wander back to the main dock area, where people, dusty and sunburned as they come down from hiking, are gathering for the trip back to the city. "Do you like to hike?" I ask Javier. His lips turn down.
"I don't know. I do like walking. Do you hike?"
"I love it. Being outside like that all day, just the trail and the birds and the trees. I live by the redwoods. They're incredible trees."
Would you want to hike to that peak?"
He points to the top of the volcano. It's not an actual invitation, but a query on preference. I look to the top, shrug. "It would be fantastic." He nods, measures the height.
"I might not care for that."
And for the first time, there is something I'm not sure I like about him. No surfing, no hiking. I'm used to more vigorous men. Then I remember the way he swam, with sure, strong strokes, and realize he's fit enough. Perhaps people in Madrid are not as interested in climbing mountains and challenging waves as those in California. We walk toward the pier and lean on the railing there. A gaggle of teenage boys, all part of some tour group, are jumping off tall concrete pilings to the water below, egging on the others.
"Did you see the trees across the street from the high rise?"
he asks. "No." It's hard to look away from the boys and their dangerous game. I wonder who's in charge, but it doesn't really seem as if anyone is. "Chill," I tell my inner ER doc. "Not everything is a disaster." Javier, following me as I edge farther up the pier, says,
"I walked there yesterday. It's a little park or something, and the trees are old and full of character, as if they might walk around when no one is watching."
I look over at him, snared by the fairy tale image. "Really?" Two boys are shouting, drawing our attention, and we watch as they scramble to a higher piling and leap off, yelling. I'm tapping my index finger on the railing that separates us from the water. Below us, the boys surface and laugh, and others are scrambling to the higher piling. Tourists and hikers laze against the railing, taking sips of water from bottles, smearing on sunscreen, eating. A very tall boy with messy black hair dripping on his back gets to the top of the piling, joking and laughing with some of the others. I see it before I see it, his foot sliding out from under him on the wet concrete, his body tilting, shifting, arms flying out, and his head hits the edge of the concrete, visibly splitting right in front of me.
"Get out of the way,"
I yell, and I'm kicking off my shoes and shedding my dress practically before the boy hits the water with an excruciating splat. I run to the end of the dock and dive toward the place he went in. The water is cold and murky, but late afternoon sun illuminates the shape of his body. Another body is in the water with me, and we meet and yank, both of us swimming toward the surface. Blood from his head pours out in a dark cloud.
We break the surface. The other rescuer is another boy from the group, a strong swimmer. "Head for shore," I yell, and we swim together, dragging the dead weight of the body between us toward the seawall, where others meet us and haul the injured boy upward. "Help me up," I cry. "I'm a doctor." And there are hands hauling me too, and I'm beside the boy, giving him mouth to mouth until he chokes and expels a gutful of water. But that doesn't raise him to consciousness. His head is bleeding heavily. "Give me your shirt," I order the other boy, and he tugs it off and hands it to me. Squeezing out the excess water, I press it to the cut, holding it there as I check his vitals and his pupils. But his eyes are so black it's hard to tell. He needs a hospital, fast. A man from the ferry appears with another guy in a uniform, maybe Coast Guard.
"Thank you, miss," he says. "That was amazing. We've got it."
Two forest ranger types are running down the beach with a stretcher, and I see a boat with a cross on it. The crowd parts for the paramedics, because that must be what they are. I keep my hands on the cut, and one of them nods.
"You're a lifeguard?"
"Once. Now I'm an ER doctor, back in the States."
"Good work. You probably saved his life."
He takes over holding pressure, and they load him onto a stretcher. I stand up and knock the sand off my knees, and a group of people starts clapping. I shake my head, wave a hand dismissively, and look for Javier, who is standing to one side with my dress and shoes in his hand. I take in a breath and blow it out, hands on my waist. It's a classic calming pose. As he reaches me, I glance down at my ordinary bra and panties. "Glad I wore the good underwear," he smiles, offering me my dress.
"Are you all right?"
"Fine." I tug the fabric over my head, my heavy, wet braid knocking to one side.
"You disappeared before I..."
Instinct. I was a lifeguard for a decade. I smooth the dress down. The panties will dry soon enough, but the underwire on the bra is going to be a misery. For a moment, I wonder if I should walk up to the ladies' room and delicately remove it. But the entire beach has seen me half-naked already. "Give me some cover, will you?" He glances over his shoulder, still holding my sandals, and moves his body to block me from view. The seawall is behind me. I reach beneath the dress, unhook the bra, and tug it off my arms and wad it up. "Is my bag anywhere?"
"Here."
He's looped it over his shoulder, so it's hanging down his back, and now he slides it down to give it to me. I toss the bra inside, take one shoe and brush it off, slide a foot in, do the same on the other side, then pull out a bottle of water and take a long, lukewarm swallow. Only then do I inhale deeply and let it out in a slow breath, looking up at Javier. I'm used to emergencies, but this came out of nowhere, and I'm a little giddy. "Are you impressed?" He lifts his aviator glasses and licks his lower lip, reaching out to brush my cheek.
"Yes."
"Good." He takes a breath now and lets it out, throwing an arm around me.
"You frighten me. Let's find a drink, hmm?"
"Great idea." We settle on the top of the ferry again, toward the back against the rails, and Javier leaves me to go down to the snack bar. In his absence, I watch the vast sky. Clouds are gathering on the horizon, moving like they're on fast forward. And before he returns, they've rushed over the sun, bringing a pearly gray light to the scene. He's carrying two beers when he returns, and we clink bottles. I'm unsettled and restless, and conscious of his body alongside mine. The beer is cold and delicious, refreshing. "Thank you."
"You're a doctor?"
"Yes, ER in Santa Cruz."
"ER?"
"Emergency room."
"Ah."
He sips his beer and watches a family of tourists settling on a row of seats. And I watch too. The mom is hassled, directing her three kids to put their hats back on, to stop tossing a ball among them,
to sit down and stop leaning over the rail. The dad is bent over his phone.
That would account for your speed.
He makes a soft sound, looks at me.
One moment you were standing beside me, and the next you were in the water.